Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is A Call to Service, episode one of the three-part public television documentary, Turmoil and Triumph, The George Shultz Years. Episode one examines George Shultz's early life, his service as a U.S. Marine, his academic career as a free market economist, and his early cabinet posts under President Nixon. Shultz's experiences give him extensive international contacts and diplomacy skills, critical experience for what lay ahead. Listen now, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
It is 1982, and America faces a world of tension and unrest. The single greatest threat remains the Soviet Union.
Here you had these old men, this decaying infrastructure, but still with the great weapons of war.
It was a dangerous time. A lot of suspicion, a lot of hostility.
On the simplest issues, no one wanted to yield an inch, a millimeter.
Ronald Reagan seeks a leader to steer America's foreign policy. He finds a man of unique experience for these troubled times. His name is George Shultz.
Major funding for this program was provided by the Annenberg Foundation, the Stephen Bechtel Fund, Doris and Donald Fisher, John A. Gunn and Cynthia Fry Gunn, the Charles and Ann Johnson Foundation, Peter G. Peterson, Charles Schwab, and Ambassador Thomas and Barbara Stevenson.
At a moment of rising global tensions, President Ronald Reagan has accepted the resignation of his Secretary of State, Alexander Haig. The man being summoned to take over the State Department is someone who has already had an amazing career. He has been a free market economist, a presidential confidant, and a dean at a prestigious university. He has been president of a worldwide corporation, has been on a first-name basis with heads of state, has managed the nation's treasury, and has already held three cabinet posts.
The local subcontractor.
His is a very American story, grounded in old-fashioned commitments to integrity and service. It is a story of passionate dedication to doing good and faith in the power of honesty and hard work. In spite of his resume, most Americans know little about George Shultz. But they soon will. As he flies at supersonic speed back to meet with Ronald Reagan, George Shultz knows what the job he's being offered will mean to privacy and time with family. But it is a call to service he cannot refuse.
If a president asks you to do something, and you feel you are reasonably competent to do it, then I feel as though you have a duty to serve.
George Shultz will become Secretary of State at a time of escalating world tensions. Relations with America's great rival, the Soviet Union, are at their lowest point in a decade, and the Cold War has returned with a vengeance. After 2 years of fighting, Soviet troops remain locked in combat in Afghanistan. The Soviets are also backing wars of rebellion in Yemen, Mozambique, and Angola. In Russia, SS-20 nuclear-armed missiles are now aimed at Allied targets in France, England, and Germany. Halfway around the world in Central America, right-wing militiamen known as Contras are fighting to unseat the communist-leading government of Nicaragua. After decades of friendship, the United States has a new enemy in Iran. The Ayatollah Khomeini remains unalterably hostile to American interests. And in Lebanon, the entire Middle East threatens to explode over a bloody civil war that now rages out of control. A world full of conflict and suffering will offer George Shultz an intimidating array of diplomatic challenges. But the new Secretary of State has always thrived on challenge. Most agree that Ronald Reagan has made a sound choice.
I have written in my memoirs about George Shultz that if I could pick any man for any job in this country, I'd always start with George Shultz.
He has enormous character. You don't find many people with his type of character.
George was a role model for me when I assumed the job as Secretary of State. But more than that, he was a role model for the department.
Shultz was a famous academic, but he was a man who didn't need fame. He preferred accomplishment to fame.
He gave the impression of being beyond ambition, and that's unique in this city.
George Shultz's journey did not begin amidst a world of power and influence. It began on a quiet street in Englewood, New Jersey.
I began with a very good foundation to my life with my parents, who loved me and took care of me, at the same time challenged me. My mother was small, but she was very strong. She was a wonderful cook. My dad was a real nice man. I remember my father endlessly willing to play catch with me, baseballs, footballs.
Topper Cook was George Shultz's earliest friend.
Our friendship began at age one, got more serious at age five, but continued on through high school years. And we were together at the same school in Englewood, New Jersey. We came here and were roommates right through all of our 4 years at Princeton.
George Shultz enters Princeton University in the fall of 1938. He plays on the football team, but never slights his studies. As a child of the Depression, he is drawn to the study of economics and its impact on people's lives. Princeton's motto is, "In the nation's service." It will stay with George Shultz the rest of his life.
George was an excellent student, and his marks showed it, and his general deportment showed that he was engaged in everything he did here, and he became brighter and brighter as the time went by here at Princeton.
After Princeton, George intends to enter graduate school. But like millions of Americans in 1941, events force a change of plans. Shultz enlists in the Marine Corps and serves in combat in the Pacific. Like so many GIs, the war provides memories that will last a lifetime.
I had a sergeant in my platoon. His name was Patton, by chance. We were very close. And things were going on, and I was looking for him. And I ran over to where I thought he might be. And I said, "Where the hell is Patton?" "Patton's dead, sir." I still remember that stunning statement. And all of a sudden, the reality of war sinks in. You never forget that.
The war ends, and George returns home with a renewed desire to continue his study of economics. He enters a doctoral program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He also returns from war with something else. On leave in Hawaii, he has met a young Army nurse named Helena O'Brien. Known as Obi to her friends, she and George are married between semesters in 1946. With a new partner in his life and a new doctorate degree in his pocket, George teaches for a few years at MIT. Nobel Prize winner Robert Solow was also a young economics professor at the time.
He was serious about his business, about labor economics. I certainly felt that George was interested in doing good for people. I thought that the reason George had been drawn to labor economics was because he was interested in the lot of the working man and making it better.
In the mid-1950s, Shultz leaves MIT to join Dwight Eisenhower's Council of Economic Advisors. But in 1957, academia beckons again, this time to a place that will change his life. Shultz joins the faculty of the prestigious Graduate School of Business at the University of Chicago. 2 years later, he becomes its dean.
We're in a courtyard at the University of Chicago, and in the background is Haskell Hall, which was the main building of the Graduate School of Business when I came here in 1957.
So as the war is winding down, we have the...
Chicago is a special place. There's more intellectual vibrancy here than any place that I've ever experienced. People from all disciplines are arguing and talking and giving you hell if you're wrong and testing you out. And you also get the importance of ideas. And for me, particularly in my subsequent life as a cabinet member, say Secretary of State, you always start with ideas. And if you don't start with ideas, you get lost.
Shultz's impact on Chicago's business school is almost immediate. One of his first chores was to bring new faces to its classrooms. Today, Ted Snyder is dean at the Graduate School of Business.
George was dean in the 60s, and a lot of things were happening at business schools. One of the things that was not happening was diversity. So, as he says, he looked around and he didn't see any black faces. And as a result, he was the guy who led the change.
Black students tell Shultz they can't afford the tuition, and they fear there will be no jobs for them when they get out of school.
And I thought about that a lot. And I went to people in some leading corporations, and I got several to give a special fellowship and to say, we will give a job in the summer quarter.
It made Chicago the leader in that regard. And indeed, the National Black MBA Association was established here.
While George Shultz was putting his stamp on the School of Business, the University of Chicago was putting its stamp on George Shultz. The place was full of great thinkers. Nobel Prize winner Gary Becker remembers.
The atmosphere was crackling in the sense that you felt you were around people who were doing extremely innovative and path-breaking work.
Shultz is particularly influenced by the innovative theories of Milton Friedman and George Stigler, two men who formed the nucleus of what came to be called the Chicago School of Economics. Friedman and Stigler are driven by a commitment to free market, unregulated economics that are based on a spirit of laissez-faire and empirical research that relies on statistics to prove theory. Friedman and Stigler are soon recognized far beyond Chicago.
They both went on to win the Nobel Prize, and both, you know, two of the greatest economists of the 20th century. And they gave him a vision about economics that maybe he didn't get at MIT, that economics is a useful tool in understanding the world and promoting public policies.
Friedman, Stigler, and others at Chicago further reinforce in Shultz a commitment to free markets unfettered by government policies such as wage and price controls. Being a dean also teaches Shultz the critical skill of persuasion.
Look at a dean. You have major responsibilities for your educational institution. And what authority do you have? Practically none. You can't order the faculty around. You can't order students to learn. Well, I go into the cabinet and what do I find? Kind of the same situation. And I think to a much greater extent than most people think, even in places where it looks very dictatorial, that if you're the head person, if you don't realize that you've got to persuade people, you've got to get them going on your side, you're not going to be too successful.
As the fame of Chicago's School of Business is enhanced, so too is the reputation of its 49-year-old dean. In 1969, President Richard Nixon invites Shultz to become his Secretary of Labor.
I, George T. Shultz, Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
That I will support you.
Schultz quickly reveals an ability to win over potential opponents, such as powerful union leader George Meany. His talent for hard work, leadership, and compromise enhance his growing reputation in government.
I'm very pleased to be able to announce here that free collective bargaining has triumphed. And we do have a settlement voluntarily agreed to between the carriers and the shop crafts unions, and we will not be having any strike on the railroads.
When Nixon reorganizes the executive branch and creates the Office of Management and Budget, he asks Schultz to become its first director.
I, George P. Schultz, do solemnly swear that I will support...
And in 1972, he promotes Schultz to be Secretary of the Treasury. At Treasury, Schultz helps to transform the international monetary rules to a system of flexible rates of exchange. In the process, he meets and builds relationships with world leaders like Valerie Giscard d'Estaing of France, Helmut Schmidt of Germany, and Leonid Brezhnev of the Soviet Union. But Schultz's rapid rise and success in Washington is stalled as the nation staggers under an unexpected scandal named for a Washington office building.
There was a cancer growing on the presidency. And if the cancer was not removed, the president himself would be killed by it.
As the tidal wave of the Watergate scandal all but paralyzes the Nixon administration, George Schultz finds it increasingly difficult to carry out his duties. In May of 1974, he resigns from the Nixon cabinet and becomes the president of Bechtel, a worldwide engineering and construction company. Schultz's new job demands international contacts and sensitivity. It is a critical experience for what lies ahead. By 1982, Ronald Reagan is in the White House. As Schultz tends to the affairs of Bechtel, he is unaware that the relationship between the president and his Secretary of State, Alexander Haig, is unraveling.
Ronald Reagan could not stand personal confrontation, and Haig lived on personal confrontation, so that it's a miracle he lasted even the year or a little more. Schultz had the most impressive resume in the country when Reagan called him.
He came to the job with more qualifications than almost anybody else at that level of the Reagan administration. His reputation was very good with most people. Some people who disagreed with him rather vehemently did not like him, but at the same time, I think they respected him.
Now, in the summer of 1982, he has been summoned once again to serve his nation. The job he is flying toward will confront George Schultz with his toughest challenge. As he lands in Washington, D.C., his journey is not ending, but only beginning.
The Secretary of State shall be responsible for the overall coordination, supervision, and direction of the United States foreign relations and for the interdepartmental activities of the United States government abroad. The Secretary is the principal foreign policy advisor to the President, is the first-ranking member of the Cabinet, and a member of the National Security Council. He or she is fourth in line of succession to the president.
From Thomas Jefferson to Cyrus Vance. From James Madison to Henry Kissinger. By July 16th, 1982, 60 men have served the nation as Secretary of State. On this date, George Pratt Schultz becomes the 61st.
Mr. President, I thank you. You have done me a great honor, and I recognize fully the responsibilities placed upon me.
I was in Tel Aviv when the announcement came out that George Schultz was coming, but my sense is that it was greeted with quite a lot of enthusiasm because many of the professionals had been very down on Al Haig.
He replaced Alexander Haig, who had made a number of what turned out to be fatal errors in dealing with both foreign policy, but more particularly with Reagan, and particularly, of course, with Nancy Reagan. Shultz came in and immediately got along with the president, but he also got along very, very well with Nancy Reagan.
So help me God.
Congratulations.
In some ways, I think it was a brilliant choice. As far as I know, he is the first and perhaps the only economically trained Secretary of State that we've had in our history. Politicians expect and hold out to the publics that they can change things overnight. Economists know this is not so.
The new secretary gets right to work. Although he has been there many times, entering the Oval Office still holds a special thrill.
The Oval Office is like magic. I never ceased being thrilled whenever I entered the White House, or the Oval Office in particular, even though I went many times because of what those places stood for and do stand for our country.
Shultz immediately understands the time spent in the Oval Office getting to know Ronald Reagan will be critical in these early days.
You have no choice except to hit the ground running. And then, of course, you can't function as Secretary of State unless you establish a relationship with the President of the United States in which you harmonize the thinking of the President and the Secretary of State. But one of Churchill's great contributions was that he understood that he had to understand the President's thinking.
He always sat at his chair at the desk, and I always sat beside the desk on the right-hand side. And we talked about issues by mutual agreement. That practice helped me a great deal because I came to understand Ronald Reagan.
Shultz's scholarly and free-thinking background and his quickly achieved easy access to the president are not applauded by many conservatives in the administration.
These people were people who thought they knew everything in black and white. And George Shultz was old enough and experienced enough to know it's a pretty gray world out there. So they never trusted him.
The new Secretary of State takes little notice of the political nitpicking of presidential insiders. He focuses instead on the job at hand.
We're sitting in the main reception room of the Secretary of State's office. This is the large room, and back there is a smaller room. Where there's a desk, that's where you mainly work. But you receive people in this office. When I came here to be Secretary of State, of course, this is a very peaceful place in its setting. And it was a beautiful summer day in Washington. You could look out the window and see the Jefferson Memorial, and particularly the Lincoln Memorial and the Washington Monument. And then when you started thinking about what's going on, what I was going to confront was a world in turmoil.
Like all secretaries of state since the end of World War II, a large amount of Shultz's attention is commanded by relations with the Soviet Union. Ronald Reagan has come into office convinced it is capitalism's destiny to crush the forces of an immoral system called communism. To help out destiny, Reagan increases American military spending by 34%. Eventually, Reagan will spend more on defense in the first 5 years of his presidency than the Ford, Nixon, and Carter administrations combined. In the 10 years preceding the Reagan administration, American policy toward the Soviet Union was that of detente, or, as some called it, peaceful coexistence. It relied on negotiation to settle disputes and formally accepted boundaries in Europe, thereby effectively recognizing the Iron Curtain. Ronald Reagan makes it clear this is not his policy. He aims to destroy communism, not find ways to live with it. When asked to define his Soviet strategy, he responds, "I do have a strategy. We win, they lose." George Shultz is now expected to execute this strategy.
The theory of detente was, we're here, they're there, that's life. Name of the game is peaceful coexistence. Well, we wanted peaceful coexistence, but we didn't agree with the underlying concept of detente. And we had this four-part agenda arms control, human rights, regional issues of one kind or another, and bilateral problems. And I gave very lengthy testimony to the Senate, setting out our strategy and the four-part agenda. And I was able to say at the beginning of my testimony that I have gone over this testimony word by word with President Reagan, and he has approved of all of it. In other words, this is not my view, it's the president's view.
A cabinet officer must recognize that I, the cabinet officer, I didn't get elected to anything. The president got elected.
Even without Reagan's bellicose attitude, relations between the United States and the Soviet Union are becoming increasingly strained. The chief of staff of the Soviet military reveals the Russian mood when he says, the Reagan administration has inaugurated open preparations for war. The risk of war is as high as ever.
And the United States was encouraging the resistance movement against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. Talks had broken down also on arms control issues and in the various SALT agreements. So it was a period of considerable rigidity.
In order to catch up with what they perceived as American missile dominance, the Soviet leaders in the 1970s poured billions of rubles into their own ballistic missile program. They cut back on spending for domestic products. They even abandoned the cherished goal of putting Russians on the moon. The Reagan Defense Department is determined to counter the Soviets' intermediate-range SS-20 missiles, now aimed at America's European allies, by installing 108 nuclear-tipped Pershing II intermediate missiles in Germany.
And he wanted to challenge the Soviet Union. He didn't think the status quo was acceptable. He didn't think détente was acceptable. And part of George Shultz's great genius was to let Ronald Reagan be Ronald Reagan.
As Shultz takes over at the State Department, it is clearly a sensitive time in Soviet-American relations. But the most immediate problem facing the new Secretary of State is not with the world's largest country. It is with one of the smallest. Lebanon is smaller than the state of Connecticut. At its best, this tiny country has been the Middle East's most promising model of ethnic harmony. In 1978, it becomes the worst. The country has been flooded by Palestinian refugees displaced from Jordan. The Palestinian Liberation Organization, or PLO, soon begins launching deadly rocket attacks from Lebanon into southern Israel. Israel answers with invasion. Overnight, tiny Lebanon becomes a killing ground. The war expands as Lebanese Christians and Muslims struggle for political dominance. To further complicate matters, the Syrian army controls much of the country. With what amounts to a civil war raging, efforts to find a broader peace between Israel and the Palestinians meet with no success. Almost before Shultz has had a chance to move into his office, he takes on the challenge of searching for a peaceful solution to Middle East problems. Charlie Hill served with George Shultz in the State Department.
He was not alarmed. He knew the Middle East pretty well, so it was not something that was really novel to him. And he was a negotiator.
America has been ably represented by Ambassador at Large Philip Habib. He has been trying desperately to arrange a ceasefire that will allow the PLO to be evacuated from Lebanon.
Our leverage was the PLO knew if they stayed there, sooner or later, the Israelis would dig them all out and kill them. And from the Israelis' point of view, they knew if they had to do that, it was going to be very costly.
But here Shultz comes in, and the negotiations seem to be close to an agreement from Arafat. And each time Habib had it up to the point of agreement, the Israeli Air Force would attack again, and Shultz was stepping into a hornet's nest.
A fragile ceasefire is established, but the Israelis are convinced the PLO is stalling and take advantage of the ceasefire to continue their advance. As long as the Israelis attack, Yasser Arafat and the PLO refuse to leave Lebanon. The Israelis deny they are breaking the ceasefire.
At one point, President Reagan was on the phone to Menachem Begin, who was the prime minister, and Begin was saying, there is no shelling going on, and I'm on the phone to Phil Habib, and I relay this, and he puts the telephone out the window and says, listen, you can hear it.
After one meeting with Israeli Foreign Minister Yitzhak Shamir, Shultz loses his patience. He tells Shamir, Ronald Reagan is an agreeable man, but decisive. Don't push him.
The help of Phil Habib and Murray.
At last, all sides agree. The PLO will be taken out of Lebanon by ship and transported to Tunisia.
But there had to be a provision for safe passage. And so part of this agreement was that the United States and France and Italy would all three commit troops to come to Beirut and oversee this operation.
Shultz is convinced of the wisdom of sending Marines to Beirut, but others are not. He is rudely welcomed back to White House politics. CIA Director William Casey opposes sending troops, and Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger persistently lobbies the president to undercut Shultz's position.
Weinberger was arguing very strongly over and over again for no American presence, or when he was overruled and Reagan supported Shultz, then he wanted to limit the use of that force in such a way that it was basically doing nothing but standing there and watching.
Caspar Weinberger has a quick mind and complete devotion to his job running the Defense Department. But he is also stubborn, loath to compromise, and completely possessive of any area he views as his turf. The new Secretary of State begins to understand he will face ongoing competition and opposition from an old colleague.
Weinberger and Shultz had known each other for a very long time. I never felt that there was some big feud between them. It's not the way of either one of those guys, as far as I could tell. But they thought completely differently. Their ideas were different. Their way of dealing with each other, of dealing with the public, was quite different.
Even if they loved each other, the institutional interests of the State Department and the Defense Department are always at odds. So there is never a time where the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State get along well, because they're both poaching on each other's territory all the time. And Weinberger was a world-class poacher.
Their dispute over the Marines in Lebanon is but the first of many Shultz will have with Weinberger. With U.S. Marines looking on, some 8,500 PLO fighters board ships and at last sail out of Beirut Harbor. Now the Marines can be withdrawn, and the Secretary of State can begin to move forward on an overall solution to the Israeli-Palestinian question.
We are concerned. We are.
But for all his progress toward peace, Shultz is soon confronted with the stark reality. In the Middle East, two steps forward are often followed by two steps back. On September 18, 1983, Christian Lebanese President Bashir Gemayel is assassinated. Believing the PLO is at fault, Christian militiamen enter remaining PLO camps and slaughter at least 800 defenseless refugees. Evidence soon reveals that as the attack was going on, the Israeli military looked the other way.
That presented us with a very different issue, whether to go back, basically as protectors of those refugee camps, of what was left, the women and children.
George Shultz is determined that further massacres will not happen. He goes to the White House the next day and, over Weinberger's protests, persuades the president. The Marines must be sent back.
I think George would tell you, he certainly told me, that it turned out to be one of the most difficult problems that he faced, and probably one that didn't come out exactly as he had hoped.
Faced with ongoing frustration, George Shultz realizes that no matter how serious its implications, Lebanon is only one of over 160 countries that demand his attention. He also discovers that often, when you try to keep a lid on one crisis, another boils over. In November of 1982, Newsweek magazine had run a major story. The American ambassador to Honduras had overseen the training and arming of Nicaraguan exiles who were seeking to overthrow that country's Sandinista government. The news set off screams of protest in Congress. It was the first cloud of a building storm. Massachusetts Congressman Edward Boland is incensed by these revelations. Now, in 1983, he manages to legislate the prohibition of Defense Department or intelligence funds to overthrow the government of Nicaragua.
Mr. Speaker, the vote on the motion is ayes 411.
No one in the White House realizes, but this legislation will eventually threaten to topple the entire Reagan administration. November 11th, 1983. Leonid Ilyich Brezhnev, General Secretary of the Soviet Communist Party for almost two decades, dies. Brezhnev had been a classic Cold Warrior. Yet as Brezhnev's body is carried to its resting place, there is reason to hope his successor, Yuri Andropov, might be more open to a fresh start with the United States. 1 month later, hope pays off. Soviet Ambassador to the U.S., Anatoly Dobrynin, sends a message to George Shultz, proposing the start of preliminary talks between the two nations. Shultz is pleased. He is determined to get Ronald Reagan to begin a dialogue with the Soviets. His chance will come with a Washington snowstorm. During a gathering winter storm, George Shultz returns to Washington from a trip to China. He's lucky to be able to land at Andrews Air Force Base before the snow becomes a major blizzard.
So we got home on a Friday, and it was snowing. It had been snowing, and it kept snowing. So the Reagans were not able to take a chopper up to Camp David or a car, nothing. They were stuck in the White House for the evening. So our phone rings, and they said, why don't you come over and have supper with us? So my wife and I went over. The four of us had a very nice supper.
After supper, Shultz and the president have coffee and talk about Chinese leaders the secretary has met on his trip. With more coffee, the topic begins to shift. Reagan presses Shultz for information about Soviet leaders.
I knew the Soviet leaders because when I was Secretary of the Treasury earlier, I had met with them and done a lot of negotiation with the Soviet leaders. And I began to see this man is dying to interact with these people and try to work them over in his way of thinking.
Given Reagan's stand on communism, no one on his team has ever recommended that he meet a Soviet leader. Shultz has other ideas.
So I said to the president, Ambassador Dobrynin is coming over next Tuesday, 5 o'clock. What if I bring him over here and you talk to him? He said, oh, that'd be great. And he had said to me, it'll be a very short meeting, because all I want to say is that if his new boss, Andropov, wants to have a constructive dialogue, I'm ready.
Reagan and Shultz agree that the meeting must be kept secret. Over the next several days, Shultz develops a plan and the meeting at last takes place.
So we go over and the meeting went on and on and on and on. We discussed every conceivable subject.
Reagan quizzes Dobrynin on a number of issues, from arms control to the sensitive topic of human rights in the Soviet Union. The meeting is viewed as a success by both sides. Shultz's initiative has just provided Reagan with a lesson on the value of direct talks. It is a lesson others in the White House are not ready to accept. Once again, Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger and Bill Casey at CIA confront the president, saying he should not be talking to the Soviets until after their policies change. Shultz is frustrated by the opposition to his efforts within Reagan's staff. His frustrations come to a head in a meeting with the president.
I did come in to the Oval Office and told the president I thought there was discord over key issues and I was prepared to resign and he could find somebody who was in agreement with Cap and Bill Casey on, after all, dealing with the Soviet Union was a central issue. He never accepted my resignation. I always feel that it's a great mistake to want the job too much, because then you do things that to keep the job that you probably wouldn't do otherwise.
So it's his birthday, and if you can say, well, above the children.
While the meeting with Debrinin hints at diplomatic progress, Reagan now introduces an issue that will greatly increase Cold War tensions. This new issue begins with Ronald Reagan's view of nuclear war. For all his willingness to increase military spending and play the part of the Cold Warrior, Ronald Reagan is horrified at the thought of nuclear war. He privately rejects the concept of mutually assured destruction, or MAD, a strategy that had been relied on for avoiding nuclear war for 40 years. The theory of MAD was that with deaths from an all-out nuclear exchange estimated at 150 million people, no leader would ever be so foolish as to push the launch button.
Ronald Reagan, long before he was president, and much to the distress of most conservatives, never bought into mutually assured destruction. He was a romantic. He was a dreamer. He imagined a world without atomic weapons. Behind his back, his own people made fun of him for that. But he believed it deeply.
When Reagan was acquainted with the facts of nuclear weapons, I think he was stunned by it. He didn't realize that just by touching a few controls,
one key turn,
it practically meant the end of civilization as we knew it. I mean, this is a huge something to have on your mind.
Reagan becomes fascinated with a theoretical Pentagon plan for using missiles and laser weapons to intercept Soviet missiles in space before they can reach American targets. It is called the Strategic Defense Initiative, or SDI for short. It is nothing more than a vague concept and exists only on paper. This doesn't stop Reagan from embracing it wholeheartedly.
I think that Reagan seized on to SDI because it touched the romantic, the dreamer side of him, of a brave new world. I don't know whether he ever thought it would work. I don't think anybody else thought that it would work.
George Shultz has not been part of developing the SDI concept and knows little about it. He is not opposed in principle, but is concerned about its impact on relations with the Soviets. He urges Reagan to proceed slowly. But before he can make his points, the president decides to present SDI in a televised speech to the American public.
My fellow Americans, thank you for sharing your time with me tonight. The subject I want to discuss with you, peace and national security, is both timely and important. Timely because I've reached a decision which offers a new hope for our children in the 21st century. A decision I'll tell you about.
Shultz has been handed the speech at the last minute. He rewrites some of the language, but fears it will be a bombshell to relations with the Allies and Soviets alike.
I didn't try to talk him out of it, among other reasons, because I knew that I couldn't be done, that he was deeply committed to this speech.
It is that we embark on a program to counter the awesome...
Shultz understood Reagan's view of SDI. Shultz had not known that this speech was going to be phrased this way and that this was going to take such a central position in administration foreign policy.
What if free people could live secure in the knowledge that their security did not rest upon the threat of instant U.S. retaliation to deter a Soviet attack, that we could intercept and destroy strategic ballistic missiles before they reached our own soil or that of our allies.
I know this press reaction to the speech is largely unkind, calling the plan a pipe dream and sophisticated nonsense. Headline writers will dub the program Star Wars. The Soviets will immediately warn that it is an extremely dangerous path. But phone calls to the White House after the speech will be overwhelmingly positive, and Ronald Reagan will take great pleasure in the outcome.
Thank you. Good night, and God bless you.
It has been 7 months since Palestinian fighters left Lebanon. With both Syrian and Israeli armies remaining in the country, George Shultz has little time to linger on the possible implications of Reagan's SDI program. He sets out to continue his search for peace in the battered nation and in the Middle East.
The idea was to get the Israelis to agree to leave Lebanon, and you negotiated security positions that would give them reassurances if they did. That was all on the understanding that if the Israelis left, the Syrians would leave.
Ambassador to Israel Sam Lewis was one of the few diplomats in the region who believed Shultz would have much success.
All the others tell him, no, don't do it. Don't risk your reputation. It's going to fail. The Israelis are impossible to deal with. You stick your head in this buzzsaw and you're going to get chopped off.
He will not be distracted by naysayers, by those who say this is going to be too hard or this might affect your reputation in some way or another. If he thinks it's a situation that demands attention and if it costs him something, he'll go after it.
Well, people are always afraid when you confront something that seems unlikely to work, that you get involved and then nothing really big happens. So you failed. And I always felt that it's constructive to maintain a level of engagement that prevents the situation from going backwards, even if you don't go forward very much. But you can make some forward steps.
Shultz struggles to forge a peace agreement. He begins to shuttle back and forth between capitals, from Beirut to Jerusalem, with side trips to Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Syria. Former ambassador to Israel Sam Lewis recalls Shultz's exhaustive efforts.
It's an exhausting business. He gradually, piece by piece, step by step, gets the American draft, spends a day persuading the Lebanese they've got to have an agreement. This is the best we can do. Makes a few changes. Then he goes to Jerusalem, gives it to the Israelis. They don't like any of it. He argues with them. He makes a few changes. He goes back to Beirut. That's the way you shuttle.
We've had a very full review of all of the issues here, just as we did in Israel.
The negotiations require enormous tolerance for frustration. The Lebanese are reluctant to put anything in writing. The Israelis want everything in writing. Through it all, Shultz challenges the discouraging odds.
He had a good style of listening carefully, of understanding the other side's position, of making very logical arguments, not getting emotionally engaged in debate, stating his own positions clearly, but in a non-provocative way, and being ready to look for bridging language when you need it. All things which good negotiators do, and he certainly was one.
I've now had the privilege of meeting with the Prime Minister, the Foreign Minister, and the Defense Minister.
Against all odds, Shultz gets both sides to agree to a treaty.
For the benefit of the
camp. So he got it all down on paper, and he got many of the parties in the region willing to do it. But if you can't bring about any leverage on the party that's causing the main problem, and that was Syria, then you couldn't put it into effect.
Schultz Shultz no more than returns home when both Syria and Israel back out of his carefully crafted agreement. The nightmare of Lebanon continues. The summer of 1983 is a terrible time for American foreign policy in the Middle East. The Marines camped at the Beirut airport are under daily artillery attack. Shultz's proposal for an overall Israeli PLO peace is rejected by Yasser Arafat. And in September, Druze Muslims declare that the Marines in Beirut will now be treated as an enemy force. Even worse news lies ahead.
President, I have bad news for you.
Early on a quiet Sunday morning, a suicide bomber crashes a truck through barriers and into the lobby of the Marine barracks in Beirut. 6 tons of explosives are detonated. The building collapses onto sleeping Americans. 241 servicemen are killed. It is the worst attack on an American military force since Pearl Harbor.
Of all of the things I was involved in as Secretary of State, the one that I agonized about the most and second-guessed myself about the most was the tragedy with the Marines in Lebanon. It was the worst moment in the Reagan presidency for all of us, by far. Nothing approaching it.
Although George Shultz has been instrumental in sending American forces to Beirut, he has had nothing to do with tying them down to an exposed position that was difficult to defend.
But it was surely for Shultz, a horrible event. He was a Marine himself, very proud of that.
Well, it's very difficult for the Secretary of State when either the absence of diplomacy or the failure of diplomacy leads to the kind of terrible events that attended the death of the Marines in the barracks there. George has described it as a terrible day. There's really, in many ways, nothing worse than wondering what you could have done.
And Shultz, at this point, I think, reacted in a way that was very typical and understandable. His position was, with these Marines killed, with the United States essentially humiliated, the United States could not pull out of the Middle East. And Weinberger prevailed, and Reagan pulled the U.S. troops, what was left of them, out of the Middle East.
What had begun as a peacekeeping mission has ended in tragedy and retreat. For Shultz, it is deeply disturbing. And yet, intuitively, he understands that the stakes are too great for him to be intimidated.
What's impressive about what was and is about George Shultz is that he takes these setbacks, these catastrophes, in stride. You don't break stride. You just keep going at it.
The potential for a more secure and peaceful planet is too important for George Shultz to pause for long. In the time left to him, he will persevere. There is no way for Shultz to know it, but better days are ahead. In the next episode of Turmoil and Triumph, George Shultz takes the lead in solving the greatest challenge to world peace, nuclear disarmament with the Soviet Union. His efforts will help bring Ronald Reagan together with Mikhail Gorbachev in talks that will lead to the end of the Cold War. On the next episode of Turmoil and Triumph.
Listen now, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.